Exciting news from the EAN. Since January 2025, EAN Campus is open to all associate members. If you're part of a National Neurological Society in Europe, you may already have access. Just log in with your MyEAN account at eancampus.org and explore top quality content. More details in the episode description.
Welcome to EAN Cast, your weekly source for education, research, and updates from the European Academy of Neurology.
Hello and welcome to EAN Cast Weekly Neurology. My name is Alicia Corroni. I'm a consultant neurologist at the Geneva Memory Center, and I also co-chair the EAN Task Force on Neurologist Wellbeing. Our task force was established to better understand the mental health challenges faced by neurologists across Europe, particularly burnout, and to promote effective preventive strategies for well-being and resilience. This work is done in close collaboration with our colleagues in psychiatry, and this podcast is one of our key initiatives. Today's episode, Senior Perspectives, Lessons Learned from Decades in Neurology and Psychiatry, features two outstanding and distinguished guests. So we have with us Professor Mider Fatov. She is a consultant neurologist, professor at the University of Bergen, and president of the Norwegian Neurological Association, but also treasurer of the EAN board. Welcome, Professor Mider Fatov.
Thank you.
And we also have Professor Fiorillo. He's a professor of psychiatry at the University of Naples and is the current president of the European Psychiatric Association. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you.
So I would like to start by reflecting on your early training days. When you started your careers, topics like burnout and psychological distress among healthcare workers were perhaps less openly discussed. So I would like to ask both of you if you could share your experience regarding how openly these issues were addressed at that time and describe how awareness and sensitivity towards clinicians' well-being have evolved throughout your careers to present day. So I would like to start with Jana first, if possible.
Thank you, Alicia. And this is very interesting. And I can tell you about how the days were. I started my neurological education in 2000. So that's many years ago. And when I started, it was an attitude among doctors that it was a matter of surviving. And you shouldn't complain as a new doctor because those who were older had had it much worse when they were trained. It was a war. Just go out in your trenches and do your job. And the wars that have been before were so much worse. So I think that was an attitude towards mental health among the doctors themselves, that it was a matter of surviving and not showing weakness, which was, of course, not always a good approach. What do you think, Andrea?
Well, thank you, Alicia, for your question. And yes, I basically share the same experience as Jana. When I started my career in 1997, actually there was no interest toward mental health and well-being and psychological distress of physicians, but in particular of early career physicians. But sooner or later, we realized that there was some stress put on us. So as early career psychiatrists, we did a survey with several colleagues from different training schools, and we found that mental health professionals and psychiatrists were those more stressed, including, of course, also level of burnout. So we started this thinking of the importance of well-being at that time. But it has been a long story because it took more than 20 years then.
And how do you think the culture has changed now? So how do you perceive burnout and promoting well-being in neurology and psychiatry nowadays?
I think it definitely has improved. And that's also why we can make this podcast. And I'm so happy that you're doing this, Alicia. I think that to have such a podcast for me when I started my career would have been very useful. Also in order to know how we as team colleagues should support each other. I think it has changed very much. And I think in society as well, the attitude towards mental disorders, to have psychic problems and so on, has deeply improved. And then If I can be so frank, I sometimes think that it is important to distinguish between what is a burnout and what is life. Because life is not a straight line. It goes up and down. There will be times when you feel super. You are a neurologist mastering all your things, a young doctor. And then there will be times where you feel that there is so much that you don't know. There is such a heavy burden on your shoulders. Usually it's a combination of private factors and factors that at work. But it doesn't necessarily mean that you're in a burnout. You definitely should do something about it, talk to somebody. We're going to talk about that later. But I think, because sometimes I see that it's an increased tendency to describe everything as being a part of an illness, a syndrome, whatever, then it's actually life that needs to be acknowledged. As a psychiatrist, Andrea, do you share my views there?
Yes, Jan, I definitely share your views, and I agree with you that the culture has changed significantly in the last 20 years. And now we see at every psychiatric conference that there is a course on how to prevent a burnout and how to balance between work and personal life. At the time when we started, personal life was not considered at all. And this was even a big problem, a huge problem, particularly for women, because they always had to do something more compared to men, and that was not acceptable. At the European Psychiatric Association, now we also have a special prize dedicated to women who have achieved goals in mental health, the Pascal Boyle Prize. We published a book on how to manage between life and work, let's say, activities. And I think that now, also from our, I mean, now I am a professor and I have my trainees, and I am much more interested in my trainees, let's say, life, apart from that of course of our patients.
Yeah, absolutely. Share the views that both of you shared with us. And with regard to the gender aspects of burnout and well-being, there is an episode, the episode 2 of this Ian Cass, Burnout in Neurology, Rare Cases and Practical Lessons, that explores this. So I invite our listeners to go to this other podcast and to listen to that. Now I would like to move more to your personal experience, and we know that understanding burnout often comes from this. So we'll start with Jana. Was there a time in your neurology career where you, or perhaps somebody in your group, among your colleagues, who came close to experiencing burnout or psychological distress related to work? How did it manifest, both for you personally and for those amongst you?
I think that it's important for doctors to share. So I can share and say I had that about 5-6 years ago. That was in the corona time. In the hospital, I was extremely busy. I had there was, as it usually is, it's a combination of private and factors at work. So it was parents, in-laws that was ill, and it was a very, very heavy combination. And then what usually happens is that you start getting somatic symptoms. I had the heart that was racing, and at the very curious moment, then a polyclinic, and really, really. So, and I found myself that I had lost my laughter. And that was really quite astonishing. And then I thought, okay, I need to take a grip here. I need to do something about my situation, because, and that we're going to talk about later perhaps, but what is important is that you don't just feel that this is happening to me, but that you start analyzing why is this happening to me, and then you can also try to adjust or to steer the ship in another direction. So what helped me through this hard time was that I had very good friends. I had a very good family supporting me. And I also did a lot of the the right things that are so boring to talk about, but so important to have the routines in your life, go frequently to physical activity, go up in the morning. In Norway, it's very dark in the winter. I had a light lamp and so on. So, but I think that was a very useful experience for me, and especially because it helped me when I had colleagues later on who would venture into the same thing. Because if you look at those, and I wouldn't burn out or not, but it's usually like that people encounter these episodes in the early day of their career, like where you are, Alice, and perhaps many of the listeners, when you have small children, or you are founding a family, you have extremely workload, you have a lot of duties and so on, and then you can encounter that later in life, like I did, when you have a combination of older parents, still a lot of work to do, and a lot of responsibilities both at work and outside work, and the sum just gets too big. So I think that was a very valuable experience for me, and it has helped me in order to counsel others, making better choices, but also giving them hope that this can be helped.
Thank you so much for sharing your experience, the experience that definitely reflects also my experience and the experience of many of the listeners of this podcast. And Andrea, was there a specific case for you or period in your life that made you realize the importance of well-being in your career and in your life in general?
Alice, I would say almost every day. I mean, we should pay attention to our emotional reaction, to what the physics is telling us. Maybe as a psychiatrist, we've been also trained to these reactions. So probably I am a little bit helped by this. But I can tell you that from time to time, I feel the need to say stop, to take one day off, to spend some time with my family. And this is something that people, also those who are at the highest level of their career, should keep on and should not forget. One of my colleagues that told me that when at the evening no one is complaining about him, telling that patients, residents, or family members, that means that he has done a good job that day. But of course, we should consider that we cannot do everything. You know, you mean that if I am in my hospital, I cannot stay in a conference, or I cannot stay at home, and vice versa. And what I have also learned along these years, for example, now that when I come back at home in the evening, I spend my time with my children and with my wife, and I even don't open the computer, even if the day after I have an important meeting. So this is something that particularly for the young generation should keep in mind. And when I was young in the past, I remember that in the evenings I usually wrote papers and letters and did the lessons, but now I don't do it anymore. And this is another lesson that I have learned, and this has helped me a lot. A few years ago, one of my most brilliant PhD students, he was now in his first years of career at university, he just said, "This is too much for me. I want to stop here." And I told him, "Take 1 or 2 months off, and then come back, and then you can tell me if you really don't want to go on with the career, or if you want to." And then after 1 or 2 months, he came back and say, "Okay, I'm ready now to take the career." Now he's associate professor. So I think that this is also a successful story, that if you need to stop for a while, please do it and consider your mental and physical health as important as your career.
That is so cool, Professor Andrea, I have to say. And Alice, it also, I think, shows the importance of good leadership, which you have been advocating a lot. That as a leader, you need to see your colleagues not only as a working person, but also as a whole person with all the aspects of their current lives in them.
as a human being, and having examples like yours, Jana and Andrea, sharing so freely your experience, sets also a great example and tells us also that we can talk about that openly. And this is the first step to then finding solutions together, I think. And as you mentioned, I think I found it similar to your experience. I find that maintaining a fulfilling career while protecting my personal well-being is crucial, but sometimes it can be very, very challenging. So you started to share some experience, some advice. I was wondering whether, Jana, you could tell us what are the activities that passionate you outside of medicine and how they have played a key role in keeping you grounded and passionate about neurology.
Yeah. That is a very good question. And I think to find something that gives you pleasure, but that also gives you the opportunity to rest your brain and do something else is very important. We've already ventured the theme physical activity, which means a lot to me. I do physical activity about five times a week, I would say. I know that you're on Strava, Alicia, and you are even better than me, but people laugh at me when I say I'm on Strava. The reason I do that is also because it's motivating to see what other people are doing. And even though you do a small fitness, whatever, and it's so physical activity is a key thing in my life. I've also taken up tennis. I'm a very bad tennis player, yes, definitely. I have to admit that. We have to be frank in this podcast. I'm a bad tennis player, but it's good for my brain to learn something. I have a very nice coach. It's very encouraging in the right places. And I've after a tennis lesson, I really feel that I have done something for my brain as well as for my body. And then I've played the piano for many years. I started as a child and then I took that up in med school again. And now my sons went to lessons. And then when they didn't want to go anymore, I just took over the lessons. And that gives me hugely pleasure. And when you sit down with a piano, probably Andrea is going to perhaps tell more about that. But you need activities that can definitely take away all the thoughts about the patients or the students or the articles you haven't written or the whatever. And when you practice the piano or when I practice my tennis badly, I really have to focus on that and not on something else. And I'm also promoting the routines of the day. I think that they are building resilience. The first cup of coffee in the morning that you are giving yourself. Just to sit down there and to have the taste and think, oh, I'm drinking my first morning coffee. This is going to be a good day. I think sometimes we're talking about these dramatic things that we want to do. Fantastic. We're going on a vacation, on a trip, wherever, and so on. But I think it's the daily routines, including physical activity and piano perhaps for me and something else for you, that is going to be what we need to get us through stressful times.
Yeah, absolutely. And as you mentioned, self-care can take different forms, can be very small, sipping a coffee in the morning or doing like, I don't know, travels, taking months off from work to look after themselves. I was wondering whether, Andrea, you started to discuss about how to set boundaries between work and your life. Are there any other advice that you would like to give to this regard? And what are the hobbies that passionate you that keeps you motivated and grounded?
Well, apart from what Jana said, on which I fully agree on the importance of lifestyle behaviors, I think it's extremely important to eat well, to drink well, to sleep. Sleep is extremely important for our mental well-being. Apart from that, I think that one issue that I would remind here is the importance of setting priorities. I think here is the issue. And priorities, of course, to change from day to day, but even from hour to hour. So if I'm doing something, I should even a tennis match, even if I'm not so good, as Jana said, in playing. But I should dedicate my, should concentrate my energy and my activity there. I mean, if I'm doing something with my family, but I'm thinking to my work, then this is really stressful for me, and I probably don't do well neither of the activities. So setting priorities, it is not always easy. In some cases, you, particularly you, if you are when you are young in the career, will be asked to do this, and the priority set is now or even yesterday to do something. So you should say, you should learn how to say no. You know, without being polite and gentle and calm, but saying, no, I can't do it now, I can do it tomorrow, or whatever. And from my experience, what I can tell you that is extremely helpful for me is to spend some evenings out with friends, you know, going to a restaurant, apart from taking a weekend off. I mean, I live in Naples, so for me it's easier to go to the swimming, to the seaside. But nevertheless, it is important to stay well whenever you stay. And this is, I think, the most important lesson that I have learned in my life. Until, I would say, mid-30, I couldn't understand this. Now, if I am, as I told you, I'm out, I try not to take with me my computer. And one other risk factor is a mobile phone, because now we can do everything there and you can be reachable anytime from everyone. And they say, why you're not answering? It is Sunday morning on August 15. I shouldn't answer to you. But anyway, this is how things go now. And so it is up to us to create some defenses, not to be overwhelmed by work.
Yeah, thank you. So I think it is up to us, but it's also up to the institutions, because you can be the most resilient person, but if you don't have an institution that is supportive and empowering, that can be very complicated and complex to navigate. So I would like to ask you whether you're aware of specific institutional policies or workplace cultures at your own institution or in other institutions that have effectively supported or promoted well-being. And I would like to start with Jana.
Yeah. And that is also a question that is sometimes asked. And the real question is whether it's theory or whether it's put into practice. Because I think most institutions at this time, they acknowledge that in order to recruit skilled health personnel and in order to keep them, they need to have an attitude towards the issues of mental health, work-life balance, and so on. I do have my main position in combination with the professorate at the state governor of Vestland, where I have a small section that I'm leading. And what we have here, what I like, is that you have 1 hour, and that's not so much, but I think that it's a symbol that you can use for physical activity in your work time. And I think that's so nice. It's so nice that they are doing this because it has a financial perspective to it. But it's a sign of that we want to keep our employees in physical activity because it has some gains. And I also think that this is also a very concrete measure, but it's very obvious. We have a coffee machine that everybody can go to and take as much coffee as they want to, or water or whatever. And in hospitals in Norway, coffee has become something rare. You have to pay for it and so on. And they are then taking away a place where doctors can socialize. So actually, these are two things done at my work, which promotes the physical well-being and the health of the employees. And they are so simple. 1 hour with fitness or training, you can do whatever you want. Some people even go for a walk and just register it as that. And you have as much coffee, tea, or water that you like during the day, which makes the coffee machine a very good tool for promoting social interaction.
Yes, in Italy, I can tell you that now we are starting this culture. And now in many universities, there is, something like a psychological support for students, for residents, but also for employees. So this is something that actually we do have since a couple of years in Italy. And this is something that can prevent, let's say, mental disorders or anxiety or whatever, but also can promote mental well-being. I agree with Jan again that it's important the social networking. Actually, we have some green spaces where they can spend some time together. Usually, we do promote the interaction also close to a coffee station rather than into a bar. But this is also something extremely important. And last point, I think that can be done also at institutional level is to organize some gathering events between among staff members. So these include nurses and psychologists and psychiatrists and other health professionals trying to be as close as possible, at least a couple of times per year, so that this create a sense of belonging to the institution. And this is also, I think, I found something helpful.
Andrea, do you think that psychiatrists are better on the theme mental well-being for physicians than neurologists? Or is it completely the reverse?
Well, actually, I think this is not an easy question, which brings us, I think, to the difference between neurologists and psychiatrists in the last years. I think that the training of neurologists and psychiatrists has changed too much, so that you, as a neurologist, have lost some part of mental well-being, and we, as psychiatrists, have lost some part of brain development, aging, and well-being. So it is something that we should each of us reinforce, because we are closer than we think, or that someone before us thought. So yeah, definitely.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we can that can be an exchange between the two specialty to find the best solutions. And we know that there are different solutions for the different problems that are faced by clinicians. I wanted to ask something about, we started to talk about that also, Jana, you were saying that through difficult times you had a community. So I would like to ask both of you, how can we create a sense of supportive community among neurologists and psychiatrists? And thinking about that across generations, so how can we avoid to maintain the same structures, how we can improve that, and how can actually senior clinicians can model healthy boundaries around trainees, expectations for a real life career? Maybe we can start with Andrea.
Yes, I'm pleased to do that. My idea, is that neurologists and psychiatrists should cooperate more, should work more together. I'm trying to do it at my university in Italy. Actually, the Italian Society for Neurologists and that for psychiatrists should work more closely together, and in particular at European level. We have now in my action plan 25-27 set some working groups, thematic areas. One of that is on brain health, brain and mental health, including people from neurology and from psychiatry, but also from sleep disorders and other experts in the field. I believe that we all, both of us, look into the brain as the organ to which we want to find, the disease or the well-being. And something like 50 or 60 years ago, neurology and psychiatry were together. It was called neuropsychiatry. And now in Italy, at least, we still have child neuropsychiatry, so meaning that for the children and neurology and psychiatry are the same, while for the adult this is not. And I think that we should find a way, nothing to lose for each of us, but try to improve the experience and knowledge on each disorder.
Yeah, absolutely. And when we talk about brain health, we need to also talk about the brain health of clinicians, not only our patients, of all human beings in our community. So, Jana.
Brain health for physicians, that was very good said, Alicia. That's so correct. I think there are three things that can be done or should be done. There are many more, but three main things as I see it. The first is that we, within the workplace, but also among neurologists in Norway, in Europe, and so on, need to create a climate for openness. We need to be able to discuss our victories, but also the cases where we feel lost, where it doesn't go so good, and things that we are struggling with in neurology. I think that is very important. And on the workplace, openness is when you acknowledge that somebody has done something good, because then it's easier also to discuss when something not so good has happened. I think that's so relevant. The second thing is the coffee machine, that you need to have social meeting points. That's extremely, and it needs to be advocated both by those who are leading the department, but also by those who work there must ask for that. And then you need to share. As a senior neurologist, you need to share your experiences with the younger ones, and you need to be open for them to share with you.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. I totally agree with what you said. And there are different layers, as you mentioned, of finding ways to create a community. So as we conclude, I know that you gave already very good pieces of advice, but I'd like to ask each of you to offer one last piece of advice, something very practical and meaningful to younger clinicians, but also to more experienced colleagues to help break the cycle of burnout and work-related psychological stress. So what would be this last piece of advice from both of you? Maybe we start with Andrea and then Jana.
Yes, Alicia, thank you. And I think that just for a few words, I would say take care of yourself. Don't forget of taking care of yourself. Life is long enough merits to be lived as much as possible. We tend to see our life, our career as everything happening now, but we have time. So don't forget that you should consider your health, mental and physical health, as much as important as your career. I think that managing stress, preventing burnout, setting priorities, trying to find the balance between life and work are all extremely good points that will take you to be a better person and a better physician.
Yeah, absolutely. And Jana, your last piece of advice.
Coping with stressful times starts in good times. You need to seek for good relations, both in friends and in family. You need to seek for opportunities so that if something happens to you, you can perhaps alter your career. You can go from clinical duty to research, from research to administration. Be open to the possibilities and seek for the small pleasures of the day and give yourself time to have them.
I really like both of your last piece of advice. And I would like really to thank you for joining us in this Yencast today. So to wrap up in today's episode, our distinguished guests offered powerful reflections from their years in clinical and academic practice. We heard how burnout can manifest, even in the most experienced professionals, and how community, institutions, and work-life balance are key to long-term resilience. As we wrap up, I would like, as we mentioned, to remind you that promoting well-being isn't just personal, as we mentioned, it's cultural and it's collective. So let's continue to work call together towards a healthcare environment where neurologists and psychiatrists not only survive, but they thrive, and they continue to keep their passion for their specialty alive. So thank you for listening to the ENCAST Weekly Neurology. Until next time, take care of yourself and of your community. Thank you so much to my guests for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Alice.
This has been EANcast Weekly Neurology. Thank you for listening. Be sure to follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your preferred podcatcher for weekly updates from the European Academy of Neurology. You can also listen to this and all of our previous episodes on the EAN campus to gain points and become an EAN expert in any of our 29 neurological specialties. Simply become an EAN individual member to gain access. For more information, visit ean.org/membership. That's ean.org/membership. Thanks for listening. ENCAST Weekly Neurology is your unbiased and independent source for educational and research-related neurological content. Although all content is provided by experts in their field, it should not be considered official medical advice.